Hirsch.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Larry Kirsch. I'm counsel to the petitioner in this case, U.S. Magnesium. This case is about whether EPA faithfully followed its own rules, the hazard ranking system, in scoring the U.S. Magnesium plant for possible inclusion on the EPA National Priorities List, or whether EPA misapplied and ignored portions of those rules in performing the scoring. Before I start with the individual arguments, I'd like to make an overall point, Your Honors, which is that in our briefs, U.S. Magnesium raises a number of different defects in the EPA scoring. We do not need to win on all of those to win this case.
But you do need to win on the first one, right?
We need to win on the first two, Your Honors.
First two.
In order to have a reversal. We did not score all of the possible permutations of different scorings. So I think depending on what the court might do with different arguments, there might be grounds for remand, but not necessarily for reversible. We have submitted scoring sheets that show if we win on the first two, that is what we call the aggregation issue and the sensitive environments issue, the score drops below the 28.5 threshold for NPL listing. With regard to the aggregation issue, EPA...
You call it aggregation. I entirely understand what you mean, but that is not the formal use of aggregation that EPA uses in this context.
Correct, Your Honor. EPA...
You're talking about the basic proposition of taking observable emissions from one source and then using that to multiply it against the quantitative aggregate, I delve into it myself, the sum, to use the word of the regulation, the sum of all the sources.
Yes, Your Honor. In EPA's HRS manual, it uses the term aggregation to refer to combining sources so they're only listed as one source. Now,
before we get to the manual, shouldn't we focus on the hazard ranking system rules themselves? And I guess what seems to me the problem is this. Under 2.3, we have directions for the calculation of the likelihood of release, and that, I believe, on the basis of the smokestack, takes one to 550 here. Right, and then in 2.4.2, we're talking about the hazardous waste quantity. We take the sources and we sum them. We sum these values to obtain the hazardous waste quantity factor value for the pathway, in this case, the air pathway, right?
I think EPA...
And then finally, the last step is the multiplication, which you show the rules on in your chart, very helpful chart, multiply lines 3, 6, and 11. And it seems to me you go through that exercise and you come up with a number that puts your site on the list.
Your Honor, first of all, I think EPA combined two different regulatory requirements, and maybe I think Your Honor just did it as well. 2.2.3 is actually not availability for release. It's the availability of...
Now, I was talking about 2.3.
Okay.
I'm willing to talk about 2.2.3, but I was talking about 2.3. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I think when you look at the words of the hazard ranking system, there is nothing specific on how EPA should deal with a situation like this. I think that when you look at the structure of the statute and the purposes of the statute, at the structure of the hazard ranking system and the guidance, they all compel the conclusion we're arguing.
You did not challenge the regulations or invoke, I don't know whether there is any provision for an exception, but you did not do that. That's correct?
Right? No, but we can challenge, and in this case are challenging, the application of the HRS in this way.
Your application argument would be that it doesn't make any sense the way the EPA has done it.
It's an utter irrationality.
You have sources A and B as to which the to use a non-technical term, the toxicity or the, what term do they use? Likelihood of release, or, and you, from sources A and B, you use the pathway numbers from sources C and D. They don't have any connection with each other, but you multiply them together to get your total.
Is that, the situation you
is
have.
Is that what happened here?
That's what happened.
The situation, I mean, does that make any sense?
Not at all.
And that gives you a terrific basis, either for a claim that the regulation is invalid as totally irrational, or to make some, or to call for an exception if there's any provision for an exception, or to ask the EPA to start a rulemaking to change it. But if none of those three avenues have been used, what does it avail you? The irrationality.
I mean, I think that the avenue is to challenge the application of the rule.
But that's the question. Judge Williams' question would be compelling if the argument of the EPA was that the rules compelled it to do what it did here. But since it chose to put these four sources together in one calculation, I'm not sure that I understand why you would be precluded for any procedural reason from doing exactly what you're arguing, that they applied their rule in an arbitrary and capricious fashion.
I think, can I just say, I think the question that I'm trying to figure out is what you're actually arguing here. So if we were to read the regulation in the way that EPA reads it, you would have an argument that that was arbitrary and capricious.
Yes.
But you haven't made that argument. There's no argument here that the regulation itself, if the better reading or even a reasonable reading were this, that it's arbitrary. Your argument is that they're misreading the regulation, right?
We're making both arguments.
Where in the brief, that's what I didn't see. Where in the brief is the argument that the regulation is invalid because it's arbitrary and capricious?
Let me correct myself, perhaps. We're not saying the regulation on its face is arbitrary and capricious. We're saying that the regulation, if applied in this fashion, would be arbitrary.
Are you making that argument, or is your argument that they are misinterpreting their regulation? Those are two different arguments, and I didn't see an argument that this regulation, if it means what they say it says, but would still be arbitrary as applied to you. I don't see that argument either.
I thought that we certainly did intend to make that argument, Your Honors.
Well, can you tell me which section? This is prompted in part by Judge Williams' question, but I didn't see that as an argument. The arguments are all about improperly aggregating them under the regulation or under the manual as interpreting the regulation, but not that the regulation itself or the regulation as applied, if that's what it meant, would be arbitrary and capricious.
We argued that for EPA to score the site as it did,
yeah,
was arbitrary and capricious.
Because they were misapplying their regulation. Is that right or wrong?
I think for both reasons. We think EPA is misapplying the regulation. And also that if EPA applies it in this fashion, it's arbitrary and capricious.
So if the words are, if the words of the regulation support it, isn't it too late to make that? CERCLA has a jurisdictional requirement about when you have to challenge. Isn't it too late to make an argument that the regulation is arbitrary and capricious?
Well, we're not challenging the regulation on its face. We're simply challenging the way EPA is applying it here. As far as I know, for the first time, I'm not sure. For example, Your Honor's Textin is instructive on this. Mm. In the Textin case, EPA was trying to show an observed release from slag piles on the property. EPA ultimately never could show that there was an observed release in the slag piles, but EPA was looking at an observed release from the slag piles. It was looking at the quantity of waste in the slag piles. As the Textin opinion says, there was a smokestack on the Textin property, just like there's a stack here. And if EPA could have done what EPA is saying here it could do, there would have been no need for a reversal in the Textin case.
Do we know about the observable releases from the smokestack?
I'm sorry?
Do we know about the observable releases from the smokestack?
in Text 10?
Well, I mean, it's almost obvious, Your Honor. You have an operating manufacturing plant, and I mean, in a way,
I don't run these plants. I don't know that.
I want to make sure I understand Judge Williams' question. You're asking if there's an observable relation to smokestack here or in Text 10?
No, in Text 10.
In Text 10, right.
Well, I think the court referred to the fact that in the opinion that the releases were more likely, in the Text 10 decision, that the releases more likely came from the smokestack.
I think we did.
I believe you did, Your Honor. The bottom line here, Your Honors, is that we really think that the statute itself compels the interpretation we're advocating for. 105A8A of CERCLA requires EPA to act to assess relative risks of sites. And 105C, which requires EPA to promulgate a new hazard ranking system, which is the rule under which this site was evaluated, requires EPA to accurately assess risks. And that was the ground that the court used in Mead, in fact, in invalidating the aggregation policy there. Because in Mead, combining low-risk sites to obtain a high-risk resolution, a high-risk listing, is contrary to Congress's purposes. And that's exactly what's going on here. We have a situation where there's a smokestack with no quantity, low risk. We have a waste ponds that have no observed release and no potential for release either. EPA could have evaluated potential for release, but it didn't do that. And so either source is a low-risk source. You have them both on the property together. They're a low-risk property, but all of a sudden when you take the waste characteristics from one and the observed release from the other, you have a high risk. It is contrary to the congressional purpose in assessing risk.
I tend to agree with you, but I still don't see how you undercut the effect of 242. I mean, do you want to? I'd be happy to be taken through an alternative reading of 242, but I just don't see it. Sum the values of each source to obtain the hazardous waste quantity factor value for the pathway, in this case, air.
Your Honor, for the rule to be rational, it has to apply to sources that have similar attributes in terms of ability to release or not, or quantities. I mean, you can't take a...
But now you know you are saying, and I understand entirely, that the rule is irrational.
We're saying that the rule is applied in this situation is irrational. Well, nothing about the rule compels this result.
Well, suppose you're confronted with that regulation. What do you do? Where's the wiggle room?
The wiggle room is in interpreting the provision in a way that...
So what's the word that gives you some flexibility? Or a bunch of words.
There are not particular words in the regulation that say this, Your Honor. But given the statutory purpose of the hazard ranking system, it has to be interpreted in this way.
So it has to be interpreted contrary to the language?
It has to be interpreted consistent with the intent of Congress.
But that really is a attack on the face of the regulation. That's the problem. I mean, it says to each source. I mean, this is a facial attack on the regulation. This is not because there's something particularly applied to your site. This is asking us to interpret the regulation contrary to its language in order to save it from being arbitrary and capricious. Well, normally we don't do that. We save things from being unconstitutional, but not from being arbitrary and capricious. But we have a jurisdictional problem with respect to CERCLA challenges.
Well, we are not trying to challenge the rule on its face. We're just trying to challenge the application here. when you look at the structure of the pathways under the hazard ranking system, you, for each pathway, they're more or less similar. You have, first of all, the observed release. Then you have the waste characteristics, and then you have the targets. And for the regulation to be applied so as to evaluate risk pursuant to the intent of Congress, you have to, those three things have to relate to one another. And I'm actually not aware of any other situations where EPA has taken a waste observed release from one set of sources, waste characteristics from another set of sources, and tried to combine them in this fashion. So, I mean, we're not trying to attack the statute on its face, simply the application here.
In case it matters, at page 356 in text 10, we referred to the smoke study.
Thank you, Jeff. Shall I talk about the manual at this point, Your Honors? EPA does, I think, in the HRS manual, give us some illustrative, some information that's highly instructive here. The manual does preclude listing sites, does preclude aggregating sources that have different characteristics, different types of sources cannot be aggregated under the manual.
Isn't that in the context of applying parts of the HRS that where the whether two things are part of one source or two makes a difference, which, so far as I can see, is not the case under 242.
Well, Your Honor, EPA treated, I'm not positive I understand the question. Let me try to answer
it. Well, in other words, I mean, this indeed is what the EPA talks of as aggregation. And that's, as I understand it, turning more than one thing that might be called source into one source. Right, but EPA here isn't relying on the proposition that the smokestacks, the slag piles, and the ponds are one source. All it's relying on is the proposition that they're in one site and one pathway.
No, Your Honors, in fact, they are relying on that. They're calling them different sources. But one might ask why they bothered, because they're treating them as though they are one source.
They aren't treating them as one source under 242. 242 applies to as many zillion sources as happen to be in the pathway of in a site.
And I think when you read 242 along with the manual, I mean, you see that EPA by that must have meant they're sources of the same type.
Is there anything in the other uses of, say, the term pathway in the HRS that leads to that result?
I'm not sure I heard your question.
Well, in other words, you're saying that EPA must have been assuming in 242 that these sources were all similar. But is there anything in its use of the terms in the HRS itself that suggests that reading? Because certainly looking at the language of the specific regulation itself, I don't see it.
Yeah, as I said, Your Honor, the regulation is really silent on this point. It doesn't say you can combine sources of different types. It doesn't say you can't.
Yeah, but it says you sum the quantities in the sources.
It does, and that only, again,
it's unmodified.
I'm sorry, yes.
Except by the proposition they've got to relate to the same pathway.
Yes, Your Honor. But in order for the risk assessment that Congress directed EPA to do, for that to be a realistic risk assessment, it has to relate to the same kind of source.
And that would go to the introductory paragraph of 4.2 in the manual.
Yes, Your Honor. Would Your Honors like to hear about the threatened species, or shall we continue?
I have just one.
Time is up, but if my colleagues want...
Just one question on the threatened species. Your position is that the state regulation has to call it threatened, right?
Yes, Your Honor. Right.
So what do we do with this Utah's explanation of wildlife species of concern as a species for which there's credible scientific evidence to substantiate a threat to continued population viability. Why isn't that, why doesn't that match exactly what's required?
That's just a word play on the word threat, Your Honor.
No, wait, this isn't the government's word play. This is Utah's. Utah, this is their definition of the words.
Well, but EPA defined the words threatened and endangered species by reference to federal law. When you look...
Sorry? By federal law?
Utah defined...
Utah defined it.
No,
yes.
It doesn't, though.
I'm sorry.
Utah has both federally threatened species and they have species of concern.
Yeah.
And in their definition of species, their definition of species of concern says those for which credible scientific evidence substantiates a threat.
Your Honor, the term threatened and endangered species is a term of art. And EPA, of course, as an expert agency, knows what that term meant when it used it in writing its regulation. A threatened species, an endangered species under the Endangered Species Act, is a species that is in imminent danger of extinction. A threatened species is a species as to which it's immediately foreseeable that there will be extinction. That's very different.
That's not what this says, and it obviously draws a distinction between federal and state because it draws an express distinction between federal and state. The table has one section for federal and one for state, right?
Yeah.
So there must be a difference. They must mean that there's a difference.
EPA says that they're functionally equivalent. EPA also says that the purpose of the sensitive listing
Can you hold on one second?
Sure.
The table I'm talking about is table 5-5, right? If they were functionally equivalent, you wouldn't get 100 points for the federal one and only 50 points for the state one.
Well, EPA is saying in its briefs they're functionally equivalent. We don't agree they are. In fact, what the manual says on that issue, Your Honor, is that there might be species that are both federally listed and state listed. And in that case, you go with the higher score. So I think the manual clearly contemplates that there can be overlapping and coextensive federal and state lists. The one thing about the Utah sensitive species list is that unlike threatened and endangered species, if you're a threatened and endangered species, that has an immediate operative effect under law. For example, you can't take a species that's threatened and endangered. There are no legal consequences of being a state sensitive species. In fact, EPA didn't cite any regulations, substantive regulations.
The only thing in the regulation is the table, right?
Yes.
And the table doesn't say there has to be legal consequences. It just has to be, the state describes it as a threatened species.
And the state has a law that does define threatened and endangered species. And it does that by reference to federal law.
Okay, I'm going around the circle. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, counsel. We'll hear from the respondent.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Yeah. My name is T. Monique Jones, and I'm here on behalf of the United States Environmental Protection Agency, respondent in this matter. With me here at Council's table is Eric Swenson from EPA. USM challenges a final rule promulgated by EPA adding the USM site to the NPL. USM also asks that this Court vacate EPA's final rule or listing, but its challenges should be rejected for four reasons. First, consistent with the HRS, EPA scored the USM site as one site with four sources and included all four sources.
I understand you don't call that aggregation, but as a matter of whether this is an arbitrary or capricious application, does it make any sense to do what EPA did here?
Actually, EPA did exactly what the HRS required that it do.
No, it doesn't seem to require it. I don't think you ever argued it required it. You said it permitted it, didn't you?
The regulations provide that EPA score the pathway, air pathway, in the manner that it did. If for the air pathway, EPA considers three things: the likelihood of release, the waste characteristics, and the targets.
Mm-hmm.
So if we talk about the likelihood of release, for the air
you have four different sources, that are two of which are unrelated to the other two. And the two of them have the highest poison, two of them have the faster or the established release or pathway, and you multiply as if they were related to each other, and I never figured out how they are.
Well, The HRS is, of course, a relative risk assessment among sites.
Yeah.
Okay, so what it does is it compares one site with another. Mm-hmm. So here, because there was an observed release of hazardous substances to the environment, Section 611 of the HRS said that EPA can assign a maximum value to the likelihood of release. It didn't have to go on and evaluate the likelihood of release from the other three sources at the site.
HRS does speak of, the manual speaks of aggregating where there are similar sites, does it not?
Well, where there are similar source types, and
similar
that's
source types,
right, yeah. Section 4.2 of the
right,
manual.
4.2 of the manual.
Yeah, that.
Now I know you're not wanting to use the term aggregate here, but why isn't what you did here aggregation?
Because EPA evaluated each one of the four sources separately. It looked at
You evaluated them separately, and then you multiplied one characteristic of two of them by one characteristic of the other two to get a total, and that.
Well,
that looks like aggregation, whether it is in EPA's use of the term or not. You have put together two unlikes to come up with a like, to come up with a two.
Well, there are two points to make to that. The first is that under the HRS, there is no causal relationship. So just because that there is one likelihood of release here and a waste characteristics value here, it doesn't mean that
you had an absolute zero chance of waste getting out of the ponds, and you had an absolute zero chance of there being any waste in what's being emitted by the smokestacks, you could still multiply the two by each other and come up with a total that would be high enough to put it on the hazardous ranking side?
Well, I don't know the answer to that scenario, the hypothetical.
That seems to be consistent with your logic.
Well,
and I know you're stuck with what your agency's done. I'm not blaming you personally, but that seems to be consistent with the EPA's logic here.
Well, again,
I'm not blaming counsel either. Excuse me.
Again, if we look at the regulations are clear that EPA scored the air pathway in this manner, and it followed the regulations to the T. HRS Section 611 requires EPA to assign the maximum value of 550 when there is an observed release to the environment. And here there was. USM doesn't challenge that. So EPA, therefore, assigned a 550 to the likelihood of release. If we talk about the waste characteristics, HRS Section 6.2 requires it for the air pathway. EPA include all four sources to that pathway where the hazardous substances associated with each of the four sources all have a gas or particulate containment factor value above zero. So here, all the four sources had met this criteria, and therefore EPA was required to include them in the air pathway.
They have to be capable of migrating through the air.
Well,
on some theory that it's it's going to evaporate, something like that, right?
Yes.
And EPA found that they were.
Yes.
It's not zero.
Right, it's not.
They may not have observed a release, but they have to calculate that it is,
yes, it has to be
language is capable of or something like that.
Yeah, it has to be above zero, and HRS 223 says that for hazardous substances that have a gas or particulate containment factor value above zero, they're considered available to migrate from the sources at the site. So again, EPA followed the HRS for the likelihood of release. It followed the HRS for the waste characteristics, and as I will discuss later, it also followed HRS for the targets. So USM's argument really here is about what the HRS, I'm sorry, USM's argument here is about what the HRS says, not with what EPA did, but as the court already acknowledged, the time for USM to challenge the HRS has long since passed.
And so the segment of your brief on this particular issue doesn't cite HRS 242,
mm-hmm.
which seems to me that controlling thing that absolutely essential to your prevailing here.
Your Honor, I think we do cite that portion we're talking about.
Cite the waste. Two elsewhere.
Elsewhere, yeah, but not
right,
here.
Right, elsewhere, right. But we cited the provisions in the brief for the proposition that we had to include those sources, all four sources in scoring the air pathway. That, of course, is something that USM says that EPA should not have done. But we cited these provisions to show that actually under the HRS, EPA had to include all four sources in the air pathway because they all met the criteria of having gas and particulate containment factor values above zero. USM also points to the Meade case, but again, that dealt with the site aggregation policy, which is not even used here. We're not aggregating sites or sources, so that case doesn't apply. And USM also discusses Texan and National Gypsum for the proposition that EPA may not base its NPL listing on unsupported assumptions. But as just discussed, EPA's NPL listing here is not based on unsupported assumptions. Here, EPA based its likelihood of release value on observed releases into the environment and on waste characteristics of the four sources that the HRS mandates be included in the air pathway. The case that is on point is City of Stoughton versus EPA. And in that case, this court said the review of an NPL listing is limited to determining whether EPA's final action for each site is consistent with the regulations, with the act and the regulations promulgated thereunder. Therefore, as we just discussed, EPA's action was consistent with what the HRS said it had to do. And in this case, it can't be arbitrary or capricious. Therefore, we ask that the court deny USM's challenges on that issue. I will now move on to the second issue, which is EPA scoring of three sensitive environments at the site. HRS tables 423 and 55 permit EPA to assign a value of 50 for each state, I'm sorry, for each habitat known to be used by state designated endangered or threatened species.
And I have a real problem where the state has a statute designating the endangered or threatened species, and these two species are not within that statute, and yet you treat them as if they were for purposes of that calculation.
Well, Your Honor, Utah has a sensitive species list that has seven categories of species. And these birds, the American white pelican and the long-billed curlew, are both included under the designation of wildlife species.
Neither of them under endangered or threatened species, right? Am I right or wrong?
Well, we think that they are designated as threatened or endangered by Utah.
That's not something we think about. That's something we know one way or the other.
Well, the state has said.
The statute refers to what it defines as threatened or endangered or threatened species, doesn't it? Am I not correct about that?
Yes, Utah has defined those terms.
Right.
According to
these two species don't come within the statutory terms. Am I right or wrong?
Under those terms, endangered and that term threatened, yes.
Right. And that's the only two that are relevant terms under EPA's regulations, right?
No, we disagree. We think that the
Where should I look to find that you're right when you disagree with me?
Well,
can you give me a citation to something
there?
Disagree with me because it helps you win your case?
If you look at the tables use the term.
Give me a page reference on the JA on that.
It's not in the joint appendix. It's in the
back of the brief.
It's section 423. I'm sorry, table 423. Which is in the appendix, I'm sorry, the addendum to USM's initial brief at page 160, or at the top, page 65.
Okay.
And a very similar table is also used in HRS.
Which table? What's the name of the table you're talking
about? It's table 423. It's called Sensitive Environments Rating Values. And if you look at the addendum to USM's brief at the very top, it's page 65. At the bottom is page 160.
I'm not finding the pagination you're talking about, let alone the...
It's HRS table 423, which is right near HRS section 41423. But I can tell you that the table does have a provision for a habitat known to be used by state designated endangered threatened species.
Right, I know that.
Right,
we started with that.
Right, and
we're
it allows,
going through all that paper trying to find this that I haven't found yet to come where we started from. The problem you've got is this is not a state designated endangered or threatened species. There are such things in Utah, and this is not one of them.
But it is.
Now tell me where I would find something that says something other than that a state designated endangered or threatened species.
Well, if you look at the Utah sensitive species list, it has a designation on there for wildlife species of concern.
Yeah.
And that's
and
it.
That has nothing to do with what you have in the EPA's language about endangered or threatened species.
Well, Your Honor, Utah defines wildlife species of concern as wildlife species or subspecies within the state of Utah for which there is credible scientific evidence to substantiate a threat to continued population viability. So this means that Utah has determined wildlife species of concern are threatened.
Council, endangered and threatened species are terms of art, though, as council suggested, right?
Yes, with
right. And what does threatened species mean in federal law generally?
But in
what does it mean? You know the answer to this question.
But the table says you have to look at
what council, you know the answer to my question.
Your Honor.
You understand that these three people here get to vote on this case, and the questions we ask are therefore, it's important that they be answered. You know the answer to that question, don't you?
Your Honor, I...
What's a threatened species in federal law?
A threatened species in federal law is in reference to the Endangered Species Act.
And that says...
I don't know the definition.
You don't know?
I don't know. But here the table says you
do
have
you
to look...
You disagree with the definition that counsel offered?
No, I don't disagree with that definition. But assuming that that definition...
It's different than the definition that Utah has in its statute that you're referencing now, isn't it?
But the table says we must look at what the state has designated as endangered or threatened.
Or threatened species. And they have designated, they have used those terms.
Right.
And they have made designations pursuant to those terms. And these two birds are not within the designation.
You're right. We think it's important to note that designated means the state has to go through a process to name these birds this. And in Utah, it has gone through a process to designate these birds as wildlife species of concern. Utah simply mirrors those definitions of endangered and threatened. But here, it has gone through a multi-step designation process to adopt these terms, wildlife species of concern, for the pelican and the curlew. That can't be ignored. We have to give...
Why can't they be?
Because that is what the state...
They're not terms that are in the operative rules for EPA. So why can't they be ignored? Well, I'm suggesting they have to be ignored.
Well,
if EPA wants to bring in other state designations, EPA is going to have to do that, not you and counsel in a post hoc justification, or not the EPA itself in an application of a rule that doesn't speak to this.
Well, there are no quotation marks around the term state designated endangered or threatened. We think that it's a broad concept. It has to be given a broad interpretation to look at what species a state has designated as endangered or threatened. And here we think it's reasonable to look at what Utah has done. It has gone through this multi-step designation process. It has this sensitive species
if
list.
If you didn't have a huge body of federal law on what endangered and threatened species are, that might be a very good argument. But I'm not sure that it is, given the background that we're operating under.
Well, in this situation, again, we think that it's not required that EPA look at only those terms. We have to look at the state and think that we have to interpret this provision among 50 states. All 50 states may not use the term endangered or threatened.
Right.
So we have to look beyond those terms to see what the state has designated.
You don't have to look beyond those terms. It doesn't follow that you have to look beyond those terms. Well, EPA has adopted those terms. It does not follow that you have to look beyond the terms.
To give purpose.
If they knew there were 50 states when those terms were adopted, didn't they, counsel?
I'm sure that's a safe assumption, yes.
Yeah, I would think so. So therefore, it's a non sequitur to say they must look beyond those terms.
To give consideration to that purpose of the provision, which is to look at states and what each state has said is important within the boundaries of that state, you have to look beyond those terms. We can't look at the terms so rigid to only consider what a state has said is endangered or threatened. It has to look beyond to see what the state has designated in that state as in threatened or endangered. And here, Utah has designated the American white pelican and the curlew as endangered and threatened within Utah.
No, it hasn't. It expressly didn't. It used those terms, endangered and threatened, in a way that did not include the pelican and the curlew.
But it does use the word threat in defining wildlife species of concern. So that means Utah has said these birds are threatened.
Anywhere it uses the term threat, you'd say it brings them in?
No, but it does use it in that definition.
Okay.
And it has gone through the process of designating these birds as such, and that means that Utah has determined...
Unless my colleagues have questions about what I've been badgering you about, would you move on to the unique biotic community for the plover?
Yes, Your Honor. Well, the same tables, HRS tables 423 and 55.
I bet you still can't tell me where I'd find that, can you?
The tables?
Right.
They're in the HRS. HRS tables 423. I can't tell you the exact page, but it is in the addendum to their brief.
Somewhere. Okay.
Those tables allow EPA to assign a sensitive environment's value of 25 for particular areas relatively small in size, important to the maintenance of the unique biotic communities. EPA correctly included this score in evaluating the site by determining that portions of the USM facility overlap with areas vital for the snowy plover that are important to the maintenance of a community that also includes the plover. This is consistent with the manual, which provides a non-exclusive list of four types of areas that qualify for listing pursuant to this section. And the administrative record supports this finding. The Great Salt Lake is an area that is very important to the plover. Plovers carry out their breeding and nesting cycles on the Great Salt Lake, and in particular, the remaining isolated parts of the Great Salt Lake ecosystem along the southwestern shoreline allow the plover to nest, breed, and survive undisturbed by prey or by humans. In fact, the greatest concentrations of plovers in inland North America are on the Great Salt Lake.
That would be very germane if you were telling us why the Great Salt Lake was a unique biotic community, but that's not not what you're saying. How did this particular site get to be a unique biotic community for the plover, which is by no means an endangered species?
Well, what EPA says here is that the sensitive environment simply must overlap with the area of observed contamination. So the sensitive environment...
Well, if the whole Midwest is considered, and this is within the Midwest, then it becomes a unique biotic community?
Well, Your Honor, we're not saying that. But what we're saying here is that the Great Salt Lake ecosystem, and particularly that along the southwestern shore, is very important to the plover. And there's evidence in the administrative record that the greatest population of inland plovers are here at this particular area. It's undisturbed, there's not much else around there, and it allows the plovers to breed and nest from prey, free from humans, and this is important to them. It allows them to continue to exist.
Aren't they a very common species?
Well, abundance of the plover doesn't mean that this area is not unique or important to the plovers. That is not relevant. But here...
You use the term for allow them to continue to exist.
Yes.
So it is relevant, isn't it?
Well,
I mean, if there's plenty of them and this is not going to wipe them out, then that is very relevant, isn't it?
Yes, it is relevant. Then I misspoke. It is relevant here. So the fact is that this is an area that's adjacent to the site. The borderline of the inactive waste pond on the site is only a quarter mile away from the shoreline of the Great Salt Lake, and there's evidence in the record that the USM site is part of this habitat that is important to the plover. Plovers have been seen in the area of the inactive waste pond. Their eggs have been found there, and they've been seen generally among other areas of the site. So this is an area that is very important and vital to the continued existence of the plover. And the habitat here, or the biotic community here, includes not just the plovers, but includes also the pelican and the curlew, which have also been sighted at the waste ponds. So for that reason, EPA scoring of this sensitive environment should be upheld.
Can you give us a brief comment on whether this is accurately classified as a workplace area, whether the ponds are accurately classified as workplace area?
The workplace area is for the inactive waste pond. That's what EPA scored for the inactive waste pond. And we feel that that is appropriate because the evidence in the administrative record shows that workers are required to come into contact with the pond.
One worker goes out there one time a month.
Well, he said that he goes
usually
up.
Usually doesn't get out of his car. Is that accurate? Or?
He said he does. He says it's infrequent for him to exit his car. But it doesn't mean he never does. His own declaration shows that there are times when he may get out of the car.
What's the definition of workplace area for purposes of this calculation?
EPA defined it to include any areas workers come into contact with as part of carrying out their work tasks.
Yeah.
If there are no further questions for me, then we ask that Your Honors respectfully uphold EPA's determination and that the site be listed.
Thank you, Counsel.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead. One more question here. I may come up with one while he's asking.
on the manual, so the manual says that it's a draft. Is that right?
It says interim final.
Yeah.
Interim final.
And can it be used by the agency to put something on the list? In what way is it used?
It's used as guidance So EPA officials may decide not to use it if site circumstance warrant. They may decide that it is relevant and use it, but it's used as guidance. It's not mandatory.
But is it a draft anymore, or is it not a draft anymore?
How long has it been a draft? How long has it been a draft? 1992. It may still be called a draft.
Has it changed a lot over the 18
years? I would congratulate you on not keeping a straight face when you told us it was still a draft.
If there are no more questions, thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Counsel.
Just a couple of points, Your Honors. Let me work backwards. The manual is certainly not a draft. Page one of the manual says that it is targeted at HRS scorers. It is a 500-some page document. It is the way EPA coordinates the scoring amongst its regions. It is a document that EPA uses, and it expresses EPA's interpretations of what the terms of the HRS mean. So therefore, we must pay attention to what the manual says. In that context, with regard to the threatened and endangered species, what the manual says is highly illustrative. It specifically says that EPA cannot do exactly what it did here. It said that species of concern are not threatened and endangered species. That was EPA talking.
So what if the state defined species of concern as a threatened and endangered species?
If the agency specifically made that definition.
No, if the state defined.
I'm sorry. I meant if the state specifically said that a species of concern are threatened and endangered, but that's not what the state did here.
Well, it does say it there's a threat to its continued viability. What's the difference between saying that and saying it's threatened?
There's two things, Your Honor. First of all, it's the level of the threat, and it's the consequences. The level of a threatened endangered species is a far more imminent and significant threat than a species that is simply under some kind of threat. And second of all, threatened and endangered species, as I said, has immediate legal consequences, whereas the state-sensitive species list in Utah does not. As far as the aggregation issue, EPA points to the fact that it has to look at the site. But, Your Honors, there are two issues with this. One is 105A8A of CERCLA directs EPA to look at releases or potential releases. So it has to look at actual releases or potential releases. At this site, there is no release or potential release that we know of from the waste ponds. And moreover, Your Honors, when EPA looks at sites, it has to look at real sites. The site that EPA scored here does not exist. There is no site at which there is a huge quantity of waste from the waste pond pouring out of the smokestack. That site doesn't exist here. So EPA did not accurately score the site. Its scoring does not reflect the risks at the site.
You did not make a claim that these various elements, call them by a neutral term, constitute more than one site, right?
Well, in our comments,
Mead wouldn't get you there.
In our comments, we did, but we're not raising that issue here on appeal. We're taking the site as one site.
Can I ask on this question about the significance of the manual? At JA7, it has a notice that says it's intended for guidance to employees. EPA officials may decide to follow it or to act at variance with it. And it says that it cannot be relied upon to create rights. So if the EPA had tried to enforce the manual against you as compared to the regulation, you would be saying, well, you can't do that. It has to be in the regulation, not in the manual. Don't we have the reverse question here?
Well, this is by definition, an enforcement situation wouldn't come up here because this is, EPA is defined.
Enforce, I mean, in the sense of, you know, legally apply it to you.
Well, I think the manual is EPA's interpretation. And in fact, one could say under Alaska Hunters, it would have to go through notice and comment rulemaking to change that.
Or it would have to go through notice and comment in order for it to apply in the first place.
Not for an interpretive rule.
Even if they say that it doesn't, in Alaska Hunters, they were giving guidance that actually bound hunters, albeit in regions, but they were still doing it.
Well, that
they weren't sending letters that said you can do this or not as you please.
Right. I mean, the disclaimer that's at the front of the HRS manual is at the front of almost every EPA manual you will look at.
That can help you if they're using it against you. So, I mean,
that doesn't usually seem to, Your Honor. So it is the agency speaking on the meaning of the hazard ranking system.
Okay. Yeah, one other question, and I meant to direct it to opposing counsel. I couldn't find it at that moment. But do you agree with counsel's definition of what a workplace area is?
That was a new one to me, Your Honor. I'm not sure of the source of that.
Yeah, I found it after she sat down, and it's supposed to be an area where workers are regularly present, isn't it?
Ah.
Okay. That's from Section 9.5.
Yes, and there are certainly no workers regularly present at the ponds, as we've explained.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, thank you, counsel. Unless my colleagues have further questions, the case is submitted. Unless we need a break. Call the next case.